suggest we start. Good morning. Welcome to the second session. My name is Jonathan Ellis. I head of policy, research and advocacy at the British Red Cross. I'm also very proud to be National Vice Chair of Sydney Sanctuary. The good news is that I'm using my voice, so you'll hear very little from me, I promise. But this is a workshop where we're going to look at more detail about how we start today around destitution. This is a workshop, so it's going to be less formal maybe than the presentation that we started today. We will have four very short presentations from our speakers just to set the scene and get you thinking. But what we'd like to do is then to kind of open up and hear from you, your own perspective, your own take. I think it's important that we have a dialogue and a conversation, and then maybe having had some interventions, we can then get our panel members to respond. Does that sound okay? Mm-hmm. I should also say as well that it's being this is being recorded for a podcast. So this session is slightly more different than ones we had previously because it's interactive. There'll be more people talking, and there will be the inevitable consent forms coming around. I know when I arrived, I had to sign about 57 consent forms. I think I've signed away my intellectual property rights to the University of Oxford for the rest of my life. I didn't read the small print, but it is being recorded, and so that we can use that at a later date. So social destitution, getting into it in a bit more focus than maybe we did in the opening session, about an hour and a quarter to take us up to lunch. And we've got a great panel, some of you we've heard from already, and with one new member. So Mike's going to talk to us from his door, he's still here, not moderating, now it's a chance to actually talk, and not just ensure others talk. Dave, you've heard from already, Pavas and Akon, Francis as well, talking on women and children's issues, and also Kate Smart, who is the director of Asylum. Welcome. So we'll just run through the opening presentations. We'll start with Mike giving a national overview. Francis will talk about women and children. We'll then hand over to Kate from an Oxford perspective and Dave from a Manchester, you know, maybe a kind of wider perspective there. So maybe, Mike, if I could ask you.
Thank you. I was just thinking, Francis, a bit like, you know, doing all Shakespeare plays in 5 minutes. We've got 3 minutes to talk about national things. But I'll try. So I think there's two things on destitution. I'll repeat a little bit of what the Dave said, but just for the overview. Two types of destitution in the asylum process. Those people who are supported, but the level of support is now so low that they cannot meet their essential living needs, which is the legal test of destitution. So essential living needs is food, clothing, toiletries, transport, comms, etc. Housing and utilities are paid for separately, but everything else, that's food, clothing, toiletries and transport, has to be paid for on £5 a day, and all asylum seekers get the same amount of children as well now. Now, I'm not saying you will starve to death on £5 a day, you will not, but I firmly believe that if you have to live on that for weeks and months at a time, it will affect your mental and physical well-being. And as we speak, you've got around 5,000 asylum seekers who've been waiting more than 6 months for an initial decision on their claim and living on that and not allowed to work. But they are the lucky ones because the other sort of destitution out in the system is those people who have had their claim turned down by the Home Office and their appeal rejected, and they, with a few exceptions, are left without any statutory support whatsoever. And I think British Red Cross sits around 8,000 to 10,000 a year in that situation. That destitution is not, as Dave was saying, it's not only for asylum seekers and refugee asylum seekers. Refugees also become destitute. And as Dave said, I'll just recap on this, I think it's a very important point. Their support is cut off 28 days after they're granted leave to remain. And that is inadequate normally, not normally, but in a large number of cases it's inadequate for you to get in touch with DWP and get access to mainstream support, get your national insurance documents, and that's why they become destitute. And I think that would affect around 2,000 a year, I would estimate. So, in summary, in 3 minutes, we have an asylum system which is characterised by destitution at every single stage. While you are waiting for your application to be assessed, if you've been refused and your appeal rights exhausted, and even if you are granted protection and in refugee status, etc.
My God, no. You set the bar very high.
Well, I am.
No pressure for the rest of you.
Right, okay, task. So women and children as a specific group are sometimes, if they're asylum seekers, are in the Section 95 accommodation. There was a change last year that children would receive the same payments as adults as a kind of flat rate. The real, one of our real areas of concern is where people are unable to leave the UK but have had their asylum claim rejected, and so they're on currently what's known as Section 4 support. It took a really long time, because Section 4 support is a card only, to even get the Home Office to agree that maybe when a woman is about to give birth, they should fund a taxi to take her to hospital rather than expecting her to walk, because there was no way with just a card a woman could get there. So those are the kind of levels of destitution we're dealing with. The other issue is that if you have children after your asylum claim, you can't stay on the asylum seeker support. You can only stay on asylum seeker support if you've had your children as part of your claim. Of course, all of that doesn't matter because the Immigration Act 2016 will completely wipe away that level of support and will now mean that somebody who is refused asylum, even if they are a family, even if they have children, will be pushed onto a new form of support which requires them to be in some way unable to leave the UK and be taking steps to leave. Other things the Immigration Act 2016 will do is removing support from care leavers, so separated children who have been in the care of the local authority. If they do not have refugee status or first claim pending at the age of 18, they'll be cut off from all of that lovely care leaver support we have about staying with foster carers, having a personal advisor, and they will become adult migrants and therefore expected to leave the UK, pushed onto this new form of support for people who, for some reason, can't leave, and left destitute aged 18. So that goes completely against what we think about when we think about 18-year-old care leavers. We think about how vulnerable they are and how there is no bright line if you're a British child between being 17 and turning 18 the next day. Well, if you're an unaccompanied asylum seeking child who turns 18, you do have a bright line. That's probably the end of my time, isn't it? So I'll stop there. There's lots more to say.
Thank you very much, Lee. Betsy from Kate, thanks.
Hi. So to give you a bit of a picture of what's happening, I'm sure there's lots of people who are already, so it's nice to be familiar. But at Asylum Welcome, we are seeing in the last financial year we have just over 1,000 people. Half of those were detained in Campsfield, half of the people in the community. Of those in the community, very, very few are in jobs and in decent accommodation. Most of them are looking for help with very basic things, housing, health, a source of income, and some of them are absolutely destitute. We are providing all kinds of help, we're providing a lot of advice. We are paid out in the region of about £1,500 in destitution payments, small payments to help people alleviate destitution. We gave out in the last financial year 2,300 odd food parcels. We have started, because things are getting worse in the last week for this time, we've started doing breakfasts so that at least if people are eating rough, they can get a hot breakfast when they come in the mornings. Like other people, you know, that we can categorise different groups with different difficulties. Refused asylum seekers are the obvious one, and we're particularly concerned about children who are refused asylum as a child. Nobody helps them to make an appeal, and when they get to 18, that's when the support system falls apart. What we've done about that is we are working with social services to get the social workers more alert to the fact that they need to help those children to submit appeals. Secondly, we're seeing people, exactly as we've been said, who have been given refugee status but are failing to get a foot on the ladder. Oxford is the most unaffordable place to live in the country, because the accommodation prices here, rent prices are the same as London, but salaries are not. It's way outstripping housing benefit levels. It's caused a huge problem for local authorities. The local authorities is reacting by making a very strict rule on local connection, and refugees are falling out of that. So one of the things that we've done about that is last year, when public opinion and the local authority opinion about taking Syrians was at its height, we said, look, here is a list of the families and individual people who are homeless in the city now with refugee status. please, before you go down the road of taking in Syrians, sort these cases out, and they have helped to do that. And then finally, we are seeing people who are asylum applicants in the asylum system who have a right to asylum support, who are being denied asylum support and therefore destitute because the Home Office has a new policy of delay tactics and is repeatedly asking for more and more information in a way that it didn't used to do before, and the result of that is people are destitute. So I just want to end by saying two things. One is destitution is demeaning. It's not just demeaning for the individuals who are affected by it, it's demeaning for all of us as citizens that this is happening in our name. And finally, I wanted to say that the subtitle of the conference is Building a Social Movement for Inclusive Asylum. Asylum Welcome absolutely is that movement. So please do get behind us and ask for support. Thank you.
Great, Ms. Kerr's very powerful speech there. And finally, Dave.
I've said quite a bit, obviously, in the plenary session before about destitution. I just want to say a little bit about NACON. As a national charity, we got a charity status last year for, since 2006 we started with about three groups that I managed to find we were doing something around destitute asylum seeking housing, and we got together and year on year more groups have joined us. We've had no funding at all until about 2012, and then the homelessness sector suddenly realised that roughly half of the people in London were sleeping rough, were actually migrants, and a lot of them didn't have recourse to public funds. Because they didn't have recourse to public funds, so the homelessness strategy didn't work, because it was relying on public funds to get people into hospitals and things. And so since that time, we've been able to get a bit of funding. We've now become a national charity. We're part of the Strategic Alliance on Migrant Destitution, which includes Refugee Council, Refugee Action, Red Cross, Migrant Rights Network, Housing Justice, and ourselves, I think that's it. On Homeless Link, it's Homeless Link actually run that. So there's more engagement now with the homelessness sector, and some of our organisations are actually working with housing associations, for example. Some housing associations are beginning to make some accommodation available. So there's stuff happening around that that's a lot more structured than they ever used to be. The sort of projects that there are across the country, there will be some that will be night shelters, some will be hosting projects, and because of the refugee crisis, the number of hosting projects has actually gone up in the last year. The number of people willing to host has gone up as well. Accommodation projects with housing, a different way, some working with housing associations, some working with landlords, some being gifted or loaned houses free of charge, like the Governor's Trust in Manchester. So there are all sorts of different schemes, some empty vicarages, things like that, presbyteries and so on, all sorts of schemes that can accommodate people. Just want to close with a couple of things that I think is really key to changing the sort of the dynamic, if you like, the way that people perceive things. And one thing that is absolutely key is friendship. I remember somebody once saying the most important thing is I have a friend when they were destitute, because that changes things. When you have a friend, when you invite somebody into your house, then they become part of something, they're included, and then they meet other people who may not actually be in favour of asylum seekers, and then they change their minds. And that's how things actually really get changed. The people are living next door to asylum seekers when they engage with them, whether through City of Sanctuary and wonderful things like that. And that's how things actually begin to change and start to change the dynamic. And the second thing, I think one of the things we've probably not mentioned is that Daily Mail obviously is a problem, and the media, but it's government that is afraid of the media. And there is a governmental cowardice, I think, that is absolutely key to this. Because they don't do anything at all to counter the narrative that comes from the media. Because they think that they'll get voted out if they do. So if that was to change, then everything, I think, will change as well.
No, thank you very much indeed. So that concludes our four presentations. Having said that, I was going to say nothing. I have to say something. I find it impossible not to. And I think the basis is about the historic dislocation between the homeless sector and the refugee sector, which is something I've never really understood in this country, because it seems the two should be two peas in a pod. And I think it's been really encouraging, hasn't it, in recent years to see the two charitable sectors, homelessness and refugees, kind of coming together, because we should, you know, we've got very, very similar humanitarian missions, I think it's important. And really just picking up on the different categories of destitution, I think it's really important we kind of get our head around that, as Mike said, you can encounter destitution at every stage of the asylum system. At Red Cross, around a third of our service users are people who've got refugee status. Absolutely crazy position. And we've got the government working with Still Human to repeat their research they did a few years ago, which showed that 28 days isn't long enough, and we're confident that research will show that 28 days isn't long enough, so we will get that period extended. But it is madness that we're using charitable funds, you know, money that people have given us to help people who've got legal permission to stay in the UK. So hopefully we can deal with the issue, but it remains an issue. And the thing that's vexing us at Red Cross the more and more is people who've been refused, so they've been refused status, they haven't met the standard of the 51 Convention, but nor can they be returned. Nor can they be returned. And they are open to abuse and exploitation. And as we've said to ministers, you know, the sustainable public policy response cannot be a £10 cash handout from the Red Cross. That cannot be the best thing that we can offer them. There has to be a better, pragmatic way of dealing with, say, an Eritrean. And I'm still haunted by a young Eritrean I met in Peterborough recently. He'd been refused. British government could not turn him. He has his support cut. He can't work. What does that man do? What does that man do to support himself whilst he remains in the kingdom? And that is a humanitarian crisis. One of my colleagues from British Red Cross said to me the other day, I shouldn't talk about a humanitarian crisis in the UK, that I was being melodramatic. My response was robust and vigorous, that there is a humanitarian crisis in the UK. We have the fifth largest economy and have individuals who are trapped in this country with no means, no legal means of supporting themselves. It's outrageous. Sorry, I just had to say that. I apologise. I'm keen to open up. Maybe initially for any questions. You've had a lot of information thrown at you over the last 20 minutes. Anything you don't understand, if you would like to probe, that you'd like to know a bit more of? Yes, hello.
Yes, hi. Okay, thank you. By the way, my name is Nao, and I'm working here at Refugee Studies Centre upstairs. And thanks for the presentation. I have kind of two questions, and one is to Kate. You mentioned about the asylum seekers here in Oxford. Many of them are out of jobs, employment. Mm. Very few people actually working. And I wonder that actually how they are surviving, mm. you know, in this very expensive city. Mm. That's a specific question to you and to all of you presenters. And if you're building up on what you mentioned, destitution is quite demeaning. I fully agree. And I wonder whether you have come across the cases that, you know, according to my experiences, a lot of the asylum seekers or like refugees in their own country, they used to be working. They are having completely self-reliant life. But by being displaced, they suddenly become, you know, in that kind of difficult position. And I came across a few cases. They gradually start feeling the stigma, defeatedness. You know, and they eventually, I'm not a doctor, but sometimes go into psychological issues. I wonder that whether you have been observing these cases. If you could share some of these things, that would be great.
Maybe Kate,
you want to
respond?
Sure. Okay. So asylum seekers cannot work by law. Once people have got status here, they can.
Yeah.
It's an uphill struggle. I mean, one of the things we do is we do a lot of English lessons, and we help refer people into courses, free courses, where they can get English in Oxford, because that's one of the biggest barriers for people getting jobs. And we also, because we're a volunteering organisation, we give people volunteering practice so they can help to get some skills. But it's really, really hard for people to get jobs, even if they've got the legal right to do it. But people have been refused asylum. You know, people are having to live on their wits, and that does mean working illegally. You're right. The lack of ability to work creates a kind of dependency on benefits that people are not used to in their own country.
and it does create a helplessness. And I think that you said Oxford is a very expensive city. Of course, what you end up with is a kind of a catch, really, that if, because it's expensive, you can get housing benefits, but if you're working, then some of these benefits are offset. So, it's hard enough for British people to navigate that kind of system, but it's really difficult for refugees. And a lot of the people are being sent by the authorities outside of Oxford for accommodation now because it's just too expensive.
Any other reflections on the point about being demeaning?
I think the starting point would be we're lucky that we're institutionally, and there's plenty of research done on the impacts of unemployment and living below the poverty line, right, for British people. Nobody's going to question that. And then you think, well, hold on, we do this for asylum seekers who don't have the benefits that British citizens have in terms of community, language, support structures, the pressure and tension of thinking, will I be returned back to a situation where I might be persecuted? Living on £5 a day, as I've said, for on average that's 18 months when you put in the appeals process. Then you make them destitute. It's not surprising that around 50% of them have mental or physical health problems once they get into that situation. What's surprising is that we still have to actually say, £5 a day isn't enough to live on. Mm-hmm. And that if you leave people destitute, you're creating, a public health nightmare. And also, I should add, that all of the changes to the NHS system mean that those who are entitled to get healthcare are often rejected. And if you're a refugee asylum seeker, you don't have access to secondary healthcare. And the NHS bill that will come in this parliament intends to take away free healthcare from all migrants and overseas visitors for A&E care, ambulance care and primary healthcare.
It's also worth pointing out that then if you ever make another application, your NHS bill that you can't pay, it can be a ground for refusal to any other sort of relief. I was also going to say about one of the things that I find most demeaning is when people, particularly women and children, go to the local authority and ask for support because they are entitled to support under the Children Act for the Children, that the gatekeeping, and it's the same as the Home Office gatekeeping when you go and get asylum support, but that gatekeeping, that hostile attitude is, I think, one of the most demeaning things. So in Lewisham, where I live, if you go to the wrong bit of the local authority to ask for support, you'll be escorted out by a security guard. So for instance, you go to the Homeless Persons Unit instead of the Children's Services. And more they have a uniformed border force officials embedded within the relevant local authority department. So when you go and you ask for the support as somebody who's been refused asylum, who has children and needs financial assistance, you will be faced with a uniformed border force guard and that hostile attitude. And some of the stories about I had a woman who was told by Croydon she could sleep on the floor of the council offices with her children. That is incredibly demeaning, that attitude that pervades local authorities and the Home Office.
Yeah. It runs through everything, really. Detention, when people are actually detained, the process that they go through, the fact they're not allowed to pack anything, not allowed to even take their medication on some occasions, not allowed to go to the toilet, and drive all the way to London and, when you want to go to the loo, when you're cramped in with several other people. All sorts of things like that. We had somebody who was in the pyjamas for 2 days because they didn't let it get changed. All sorts of things. That's incredibly demeaning. All that sort of stuff. You're just not treated as a human being, I think. And it runs right the way through the system.
Good, thank you. I think there's a comment in the front and in the back as well. Two comments there and on the back.
I'm asking, with your charity, the work you're doing, providing homes in Manchester, do you do that also with failed asylum seekers?
That's primarily what it is. So, In Manchester, you don't get any government funding for it. So, initially, it was people who were willing to take folks into their homes, sort of hosting scheme. And then somebody donated their house or a house that they had. I was in a meeting and I said, if anybody got a house to give us, see me afterwards, and somebody said, I've got one. And so that's how we started with that, and we've had that on loan for 12 years now, and then somebody else had a bit of money and they bought one for us to use, and we've now got 15 in Manchester, 11 of which we're using for destitute asylum seekers and 4 for refugees, so that we can get some income in to try and balance the books, because we've still got to maintain the houses and look after the people in them, and you know, and pay for workers and so on, all of that. So there are some schemes where they where they're almost sustainable in the way they do things. So in Middlesbrough, where housing is cheap, they up there, Open Doors North East, work with landlords, with private landlords, and they charge a management fee. So they manage the houses. They take a 15% fee for doing that, and they will put in, on average, 3 refugees. So the income from the refugees, that will pay the landlord, and then there's one room, they will put a destitute asylum seeker in. So it sort of works reasonably well doing it that way. That's a fairly sustainable scheme.
Yeah, yesterday we heard about a couple who does this type of job in Germany. And because I have the experience of failed asylum claim and not being supported, also I've been destitute with 3 children. Even at the moment, I live in a one bed, one seat with my 3 children. And yesterday I started thinking about if there is a way those things could be replicated, even maybe in so many areas around here, even in the southeast, where asylum houses are not normally given.
Yeah.
Because it's not that I'm having a very rich knowledge of how these things work, but I do know that I just was provided support through Migrant Help and then British Red Cross. I'm working with them at the moment. And I was thinking whether there will be another big charity, maybe, that could work alongside, that would be well known out there in situations where the government says no, then maybe that charity could be able to assess the situation, which would be at the top there, probably not maybe the small ones in there, but if we, there is a need to partner and work on that side and create some sort of...
The way that we work in ACORN is we resource our member organisations as much as we can. So it's all about helping with their capacity to deal with things in their local situation. So here in Oxford, the City Sanctuary Movement, and Wyon, he got Host Oxford started, so there is some hosting now happening in Oxford. In London, the only way that things work in London pretty much is through hosting, or if you've got housing associations. So Praxis, which is one of our members in East London, they are working with Metropolitan Housing Association, and they've got, I think, 3 or 4 units probably for people. So it depends on the area as to how things work, but it's very much a case of trying to support the local organisation. Sometimes they're just run by volunteers.
What do you have in Kent?
Nothing in Kent at the moment, absolutely nothing. But there may be some possibilities in the future. We're trying to extend the net so that nobody falls through. You know, the basic aim is that every area where there are destitute asylum seekers should have a project.
So there's a point of excellent thing that has been waiting.
For a long time I've been struggling to actually understand the prevailing situation, you know, the difficulties migrants are experiencing, or migrants of different categories. And as far as I have seen and heard, it appears to me that the burden to support these categories of asylum seekers is on non-state actors, to be honest, because with the government it's going to get worse and worse. I do see a conflict of interest here. It's not in government's interest to help any migrant, you know. And we would be actually developing false hope, expecting government to do anything. And I think I would be looking at actually strengthening partnerships, you know, social community partnerships, and expect probably as well from the goodwill of citizens of this country, because this conflict of interest, I don't see it being breached, because they have it written down in many ways, you know, that they need to reduce numbers of migrants. So they don't see migrants as human beings, they see migrants as statistics. Yes. So migrants don't exist, you know, as human beings. They are statistics. They are problem makers, you know, they are creating a problem. So no matter how much politicians will sugarcoat things, or lawmakers will be discussing and sugarcoat what they are doing, bottom line, it's going to get worse. And we just need to strengthen our partnerships with non-state actors and see how we can help people in this situation. Is the way I'm led to think.
Okay, thank you. We're going to say that we'll have a few more points, and then we'll get our panel to respond. Thank you. At the back.
It directly relates to the last comment. I thank Dave this morning for bringing in the example of slavery, because I think that we do need to think that the problem is deliberately made. So when we cry about humanitarian situations, and we understandably get upset when we see our friends treated in ways that, you know, seek to break their mental health, I think we need to call a spade a spade. There is a word for this, it's called deterrence. And the government in the UK is unusual in the European Union in being very open about deterrence. They actually use the word deterrence, which is a word used for warfare. I mean, it's a word used in war. It was used for the nuclear deterrent. It's deliberately designing policies to put people off thinking that this is an easy country to come into and to stay in and to remain in and to move through and to settle in. And so that's what we're faced with, picking up the pieces. I think the Red Cross is very admirable in saying that there's a humanitarian crisis, because of course no country wants to be shamed into doing something about, like Greece took a long time to admit that there's a humanitarian crisis in Greece. I think if we carry on just on this line, saying that there is a humanitarian crisis and that civil society may do its best to pick up the pieces, but really can't keep picking up pieces that the government's deliberately breaking. Because what we're actually doing, I agree with the last speaker, we have to strengthen civil society, but we're also running around emptying our pockets as activists to pick up the pieces that they're deliberately breaking, which we're then picking up, making their policies look less inhuman than they are. So I'm really in a dilemma politically what we should do, because it's great to say let's break the system, it's like slavery, let's get a new system, but until then, do we let people fall through the cracks in order to shame the government? Do we let people die in order to shame the government? Because one is very tempted to say yes, let you pick up the pieces of your mess you've made, but that's an evil policy, of course, to not care at a human level. It's impossible. And yet the government is creating so much stress that people get burnout. And that's their idea too. They want the churches to get burnout, they want the activists to get fed up, they want people to get, you know, oh, they don't really need our help anymore, I'm tired of this, I'm having a breakdown myself. And I see more and more of my friends just can't deal with the level of need that exists in the asylum community. And I mean the destitute, and it's really causing problems now for everybody. And I think we all need to say, look, we have burnout. You flipping deal with this, or we're going to land some bodies on your door and sit in the Home Office or something. I mean, something needs to give here.
So two and a half points.
Sorry.
No. Any other contributions on that theme? I think that's one there and then on the other side.
Okay. Well, I guess I wanted to, Francis, actually, I was going to ask if you could comment a bit on the Immigration Act, which and the changes to the local authorities' children act duties.
Okay, so just hold that one. We will come to that. We had two really strong challenges on what we should do. Really powerful speeches. Mm-hmm. Any other contribution you want to contribute?
Yes, I've been listening to this, and it's going into depression. I work for Crisis, which is a charity for the homeless, and I teach ESOL to migrants and immigrants and asylum seekers. And it occurs to me that a strength we have, which is not really being exploited, so I'm kind of trying to turn it into something that's good that we've got, is the voices of the immigrants themselves. In one class that I gave, for example, I have a lot of people, Eritrean, Sudanese, Syrians, Afghanis, people from zero English right up to level one, all in the same lot. And we had one really interesting discussion one day where the Eritreans and the Syrians had this lighthearted bantering between them, where the Eritreans were telling the Syrians that they were lucky because they were smuggled inside the lorries and the Eritreans had to come in underneath the lorries. And then the whole English was talking about parts of the lorries and what's the word for the lorry. They realized that it was all told in good humor. They were all happy. They were kind of, you know, they weren't going, oh, my horrible situation. It seems to me that when we put people together from different countries, with different situations, and we start telling their stories in a way that people can hear them, because right now we're getting this case is, oh my God, and this case, oh my God, and this case, oh my God, and it's just depressing. But if we can somehow put these stories together and tell them in that kind of, I'm not going to say lighthearted, but I can't think of another word. Rather than saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, which is true, this is wrong, this is wrong. But say, these are people, these are human beings, these are people with hearts, these are people with talent, these are people with knowledge. I mean, some of the people that I teach, what a treasure we have among them, with their talent, their knowledge, their heart. And I think that's where we have a strength. And I don't know how. I don't know how. But I think that needs further exploitation.
So just any other contributions on this theme before we go back to our panel? One more, and then we'll get our panel's reflections. Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of, I guess, add and ask a question following on from the kind of way that civil society is sort of picking up the pieces where the sort of state was, or the state is sort of washing its hands of certain groups, and I guess I wanted to kind of take that line of thought we've been engaging with one step further and say that it seems to me kind of within, I guess, the sort of more broadly around lots of different kinds of migrants, that not only is it a sort of unwillingness to support, but there is a kind of creeping enforcement agenda, whether it is in the kind of asylum sector or more broadly, you know, people being debt to NHS as a, you know, as Francis mentioned earlier, debt to NHS meaning that you're not able to have an application further or your credit rating is damaged and so you can't actually secure a tenancy, or whether it's around a kind of policing of local connections so rigorously that people are being forced kind of out of a place where they have support or out of the country in its entirety. And I just sort of wondered if, I guess, your experiences in the kind of voluntary trajectory towards society, if you had experiences of that, if that was something that you could speak about or reflect upon at all.
So thank you. Let's just pause there. Some really powerful interventions. Thank you. Let's hear from our panel any reflections, and also Francis, what about the immigration bill as well. I think Dave, you were really keen to get in there.
In terms of, if you're on the front line, you don't have time to do research and stuff. One thing I would love to happen is for some colleagues out there to do some research on the cost of the asylum system, the true cost of the asylum system, the true cost of the deterrent effect of the asylum system. Because the government is always arguing about economics, about the economic prosperity of the country and stuff like that. What we can probably get the cost of what the detention and unnecessary cost of that. But what about the cost of the enforcement policy? You know, the people that they employ to round people up, the razor wire they put around things and Calais and all of that stuff. And the cost of the country of the huge amount of work that goes in from voluntary organisations. It must be millions and billions of pounds of effort that we put in, whether it's Red Cross or NACO members or Amnesty or whoever it is, trying just to help, help the asylum seekers in this country.
Not to mention the
cost to the NHS of having people in hospital beds that they can't or they don't want to release because they've got nowhere to go. We get phone calls from hospitals saying we've got this person here, they've got no recourse to public funds, we don't want to put them on the streets, but we can't keep them in a bed. The cost is absolutely huge, and if we could make an economic argument, then surely people would start to listen. The cost of not employing people who've got skills, whether they're doctors, nurses, whatever they are, there's a huge, huge cost.
I can take up that point because it's true the government has had a deterrence policy, what they now tend to refer to as a hostile environment policy. Hostile environment. So you make the environment hostile so people don't want to come here, or if they've been refused, they want to go home. And, as someone who works with government quite a lot, we put these points in government quite frequently because I agree with you, they think there is a conflict of interest, but there is no conflict of interest. It's actually in the government's interests, just as Dave's pointing out, to do a lot of the policy changes that we're suggesting, and I think we do need to change. We can't just hold up our hands, because in actual fact, the whole idea of hostile environment is they do want that kind of publicity, because it sends that message. The practice is that message never gets across, and these policies have never worked. I'll give you this one. I was saying to the government just the other day, you've got a policy on Eritrea that you changed last year to say, basically, it's pretty safe in Eritrea, or it's a lot better than it was. We don't need to be granting as many people as we were. Let's change the policy and say that if you're fleeing forced conscription, for example, we can send you back. So in the last year, recognition rates of Eritreans have gone from 80% recognition rates down to 40%, and in the same period of time, appeals that are successful have gone from 40% to 80%. Right?
Yeah.
But the number of appeals previously was 10 or 20 a quarter. Last year, it was over 1,000. Cost of those appeals being overturned, £9 million. Right? I'm arguing for this rate to go up by a pound on the government's own methodology, cost £1.5 million, right? And this is what we're talking about. The policies don't make sense. The reason the government pursues these policies, I'll give you another example, integration, right? We recognise someone as a refugee. We've heard from refugees, I'm sure you've heard this, but these people, like JP, they've got skills. They could be providing to this country, making a contribution socially and economically, and we are preventing them from doing that. The last integration strategy we had in the UK, there is one in Scotland, was in 2005. If you come as a Syrian or through the relocation programmes, there is some integration support. But asylum seekers who are granted refugee status get no integration support whatsoever. So not only when they're struggling in their 28 days to find some accommodation they can't find it, but actually all of the problems afterwards, nobody guides them through. And so their opportunity to actually provide to this country is very much reduced and slowed. And on top of that, the government's introduced a safe review policy whereby they're basically saying, well, you may have got refugee status, but that doesn't mean things couldn't improve and we'll send you home. How does that look to an employer or someone who's offering a student house? I think the key problem, now I think a lot of the problem isn't just the government, it's all the opposition as well. They're equally spineless in terms of how they, not all opposition, SNP and Lib Dems are exceptions in that respect. But they are scared of public opinion. To such a extent, they won't follow the policies that make sense. And that is the problem that we have. We can get around the table, any of us do, and talk to governments and civil servants, and they recognise that. But ministers don't want to know because they don't want to push anything that might be considered negatively in their own constituencies. But as Abel was saying this morning, actually the perceptions of public hostility are not accurate. You know, and as soon as you talk about should we bring Syrians in, everyone gets on board and we're bringing 20,000 Syrians in. And then we're bringing 3,000 children in. And now we're bringing in an unspecified other number. But the other point I'll take in is you're right, we need to, I think everyone agrees exactly what you're saying, we do need to be able to build civil society, not only so that we can provide services, but so that we can actually campaign and advocate more effectively. But we also need to support local authorities. I mean, some of them are not particularly well disposed, as I'm sure Francis is going to do that. But the other thing is, I think we need to recognise that it's a very small number of local authorities that support asylum seekers. There's only 61 last year that had more than 100. And those 61 local authorities will also be the ones that are dealing with refugees who are being resettled, and they'll also be the ones who are dealing with destitute asylum seekers for the reasons we've all talked about, and they're also having their budgets cut. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing that convergence of civil society suffering because we don't have budgets, we don't have a staff, and local authorities as well. And what we want to avoid, and why we can't stand back, is if we stand back, let's look at integration, for example. We're having, you know, 4,000 people resettled to areas. If we're not helping to make that integration successful, what are we going to have? We're going to have stories saying, we took these people, they don't contribute, they're socially excluded, we should send them home, we shouldn't take any more. Yes. And so we have to make things work,
yes,
and work at a community level to change attitudes in the way that we've been talking about, so that governments and opposition actually do what is sensible and what many of them want to do anyway. And we have to show them that they should be scared not to do the right thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mike, that's really powerful. Before we move on, let's hear from Francis and then Kate.
Yeah, okay, so I was going to say there is something obviously about there is a safety net as a whole, and there is an ideological drive to reduce and to shred that safety net, not just for people who come to the UK, but people within the UK. And I think we need to recognise that. I think one of the reasons the homelessness sector has got on board a lot more with these actions and with helping initiatives of migration is because a lot of the policies, kind of migration and asylum seekers are the canaries, because that kind of removal of a safety net there feeds back into policies that remove the safety net for everybody else. And if you look at a lot of the measures in the Immigration Act, things like you will have to produce a passport to open a bank account, you will have to produce your identity documents to rent a house. You know, that impact on all of us. And I think that's quite important to point out, particularly when we talk about using the non-state sector. Well, we have to pull everybody in. But it is very frustrating because every time non-state actors get together and produce things that are positive and that assist, what we have is this big society government saying, well, we didn't need to do it because civil society have done it, and we don't need to fund it because civil society have funded it. And when we talk about burnout, I think it's important to recognise there is personal burnout, there is local authority burnout, you know, local authorities who once were happy to assist fat children and families who were presenting under the Children Act because they needed resources are now gatekeeping more and more and more. So there's that kind of local authority burnout, there's personal burnout. There is GP burnout. They're going to increase charging for primary healthcare, so going to a GP, going to A&E is going to be, you're going to need to pay. And previously when they suggested this, the GPs were one of the strongest allies to say, we are not going to be checking people's immigration status and we are not going to have that conflict. But actually the BMA GP committee voted to remain neutral this time around. Yeah, so there's burnout from people who are our allies, and that's really, really difficult to deal with, and we have to kind of keep being strong and vocal to try and counter that. On the Children Act Duties and Immigration Act, what will happen, and it has not commenced yet, and we don't have a date for commencement, it's likely to be 2017. So currently, families with children or single parents with children can present to the local authority if they do not have immigration status, if they do not have, if they're trapped in this cycle of not being able to work legally, not being able to rent. They can present to the local authority and say, our children are children in need.
They are we are destitute, therefore, face value, our children in need. You need an immigration application to be in process or ideally, depending on the local authority, actually handed in, so you need to be kind of awaiting some kind of clarification on status. And what they will do is to say that is no longer going to come under the Children Act. Although there's a children and children in need, we'll hand that power to the Home Office. And it will become, instead of a Children Act duty and about children in need, it will become about the Home Office and funding the bare minimum that they are required to under international conventions so that we don't have destitute children. It will all be done under regulations, so it's really unclear at the moment what it will look like. It's likely to be kind of Section 4 levels, £5 per day, very low levels of support. But it's currently very low levels of support that the local authorities will give anyway. It's likely to result in greater interference in families' lives because it's going to be money either from the Home Office they give to local authorities to give out, but then they'll want to see something, won't they? They'll want to see what's happening in your immigration application. They'll speed your application through. They'll want to see what steps families are taking to leave. It's also likely to come with transfer out of highly populated local authority areas where rents are high and into something like Section 4 accommodation or asylum seeking accommodation in areas outside London, outside the South East, up in Redcar and Preston and Glasgow. And that's going to be a real problem because I think a lot of families, remember these are children in need, we've said, are going to say, but our networks are here, our children are at school here, everything we need is here, we don't want to move, thanks. And I suspect then the Home Office will wash their hands of the situation, and I'm not quite sure what will happen there, but I think it's very likely that we'll see more families pushed into destitution, pushed underground, which we know has happened, because when they tried to make families destitute previously, I think it was over 150 families, 38 went off radar last time they tried to make families destitute. So that's going to go really well. Section 17 will still remain if there's any additional needs for children. So there is still going to be some sort of Children Act assessment if children have additional needs. But it removes the children focus. Mm-hmm. It becomes an immigration and a financial focus, which I think is a real loss. But we'll have to see what happens in the regulations. Who knows? None of our statutes are very clear about it. They only ever give government powers to introduce regulations.
Well, I think it's very, very important. And finally, is there a response from Kate before we move on?
Sure, okay. What I'm going to do, I think, is try to pick up some of the points that were made by people who are not on the panel, because such a lot of useful and sensible stuff has been said. The hostile environment that's coming in is about deterrent, and the difficulty is that there is nothing legally that you can do to people in this country that is so bad they will pack up and go back to places that are dangerous. But what we are seeing in Oxford is what it is pushing people towards is suicide attempts. Mm-hmm. You were asking, do we have an example about how the enforcement mm-hmm. agenda is working through different services? We have a case which I know my colleagues from the Children's Society know very, very well, happening right now in Oxford, of an unaccompanied teenager who arrived here at 14, was refused asylum, a year later has attempted a suicide in a particularly horrible way, and ended up in hospital needing operations, and has been told, A, that he's been charged for the cost of those operations, and B, that he has now had a letter from the Home Office saying, you know, that his case has come to the top of the pile, the inference being that the hospital has notified the Home Office. Yes, there are examples. Just picking up on some of the other points that were made about civil society responses and partnerships, absolutely, yes, this is what is holding some of these people's lives together. And I think in Oxford, I didn't mention it earlier, I should have done, I think we're doing partnerships well. You know, our £15,000 a year that we're spending on destitution payments, half of it is coming from the Red Cross, and we're very grateful. The Children's Society and us are working very closely together on the young community children that are coming through. We're very grateful to Process Skylight for working with us on English lessons. So there are these groups, and the hosting scheme is picking up people who are homeless. So lots of things. And I think that we, just to pick up your final point about raising people's voices, yes, this is something we would love to be able to do if we get a project together to properly train and support people to raise voices. I know Jonathan's an expert on this. And I also think, in addition to raising the voices of the individual clients, we need to raise Oxford's voice, because, you know, if you can't do this in Oxford, then where can you do it in this country? Then you can get a powerful voice coming from outside London in support of the kind of people we're talking about.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. So let's hear some more voices, maybe people who haven't had a chance to speak yet. So back in that Rose.
I have a kind of a funny thought, because it's something that doesn't really get talked about much, and for obvious reasons, but you know, one of the main kind of links and relationships that never gets talked about is that between kind of the voluntary sector or statutory sector and, well, the illegal sector, because actually for so many people, the illegal sector is not something that can be avoided. People will have to work illegally, and for some people that can actually be quite a positive outcome. But some people it would be an absolutely terrible outcome. And I think it's a really important discussion to have. How can statutory and voluntary sectors have some sort of an input into what those outcomes will be, and how they can be, how people can be supported to have to enter into the illegal sphere? But it's a really difficult one to engage with, I guess, so I wanted to hear people's thoughts.
Thank you, it's a really powerful point. Thank you. Rose, back.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on a few things you've been talking about, Francis. I'm a, for the Red Cross across the Thames Valley, and we're certainly seeing increasing gatekeeping going on across statutory departments. And also it feels like that culture of disbelief that people so often talk about in the Home Office filtering now into social care services, mental health services, and so often where there is a duty, there's a duty under statutory, we can eventually only get that door pushed open if we get legal intervention, and there's a pre-action letter. When the new immigration bill comes along, there's no doubt that it's probably going to put people in more situations of destitution. Yeah. And we're going to have to turn more and more to those local authority departments, particularly where there's children involved. And then it feels that the people working within those care departments, the practitioners on the front line working within those care departments, like you say, are the culture is shifting, and there's burnout, and there's disbelief, and there's that. And I suppose, do you sense that there's what work could be done with those statutory departments, those people working within those departments? I mean, the director of social services, are they saying to the government, Helen, if you do this, yes, this is going to shift this problem here, and then we're going to have to, and we can't have this increase. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Are those...
Yes.
Yes. They are, but one of the things that... Sorry, so no...
Well, this is for those...
Yeah,
any other contributions? I think one of the back ones...
I just had a question from Francis, but if you could touch on narrowing post public funds and domestic violence, mm-hmm. access to services around that, or lack thereof.
Thank you for that. Then the question that the front end...
I just wanted to respond to you. I work for the local authority. I completely take your point about increasing gatekeeping and disbelief and all that, mainly motivated by our increasingly lack of resources.
Well, yeah.
But I just wanted to say that they are definitely making those points. I mean, I myself was involved in writing a response to it's an immigration bill, and about what we feared would happen with increasing destitution and people going underground and being open to exploitation and all that sort of thing. The whole local authority sector made that point very clearly to government. Yeah. So I just wanted to say.
So just hearing the points of burnout here, but also we can't have our back, and also we don't want the government to use it as an excuse to not take responsibility. Where's the
I guess, the balance. And just this morning I was chatting with a lady who's part of Oxford Hosting Scheme, and she actually shared a really positive story in that she's now hosted two people. She lives in quite a small village, and it's been positive for both herself and the people she's hosted. It's been this cultural exchange. So it's helped those people who've come to, I guess, get familiar with living in the UK. She's introduced them to that. She's had a rich experience herself, but it's had a wider impact on her village, which before has been quite closed. And because they've had to have this close interaction, which they've never had before, which is quite closed, it's like opened people's eyes in that village, and it's had a good impact, actually, wider than, you know. And I think actually, if we say it's not our responsibility as civil society, it's government, we miss out on those, you know, those opportunities for this rich exchange with someone just being in like a poor quality mass accommodation, and there's this divide, you know, and ghettoisation, etc., etc. Where is that balance? Is my question. But just wanted to share that encouraging story.
Right. So, again, great points. Thank you so much. I'm going to have to invite Frances to respond, and then any other points.
Yes.
Frances.
Okay. Local authorities, I think, do and are aware and are pushing back. One of the most irritating things about the Immigration Act was obviously government took all the responses from local authorities and said, "Well, how about we just take the financial burden away from you, and we'll pay that money, and you don't have to, and then it's not your problem." As though local authorities were sort of destitute people within the local authority area. And where there is a conflict, particularly for care leavers, for local authorities, is between the Children Act requirements and the Immigration Act requirements. And that's a huge conflict that nobody has really solved for local authorities. And it is really hard. Budgets are decreasing and will decrease further, and I think we will see a lot of social care departments actually pushed out into the private sector, which is potentially going to make the situation worse. I don't know, to be honest. But there is this kind of lack, maybe, of understanding from central government about what they're expecting of local government. And, you know, like I said, they haven't resolved this Children Duty Immigration Act obligation conflict at all. It's quite interesting, there's an NRPF network, which is largely local authority-based and actually is quite a powerful voice for local authorities. But one of the things they keep saying is, civil society doesn't really want to work with us, and we really need those partnerships, and we really kind of need that strength to push through some of our arguments and to kind of make them stronger. So there is kind of, at a higher level, I think there certainly is pushback and willingness to engage with local authorities. I will say, though, I went to a local authority meeting and they said, well, that you've got this conflict, and they said, what are we going to do? Why has no one told us about this? What are we going to do? And I said, well, probably you'll need to get children immigration advice before they turn 18, so that when they become care leavers, there won't be this conflict of care leavers, but young migrants who local authorities are able to support. And they said, well, that's privately paid, and we're not going to do that. Why would we do that? We can't. We've got the money. And so there is kind of, there are still walls, and there's still quite a lot of lack of understanding, I think. Although there are also pockets of good practice. That's the other thing. I mean, also, I'm a lawyer, so my reaction to pretty much everything is pre-action protocol letter, bring in the lawyers. If we can't negotiate, we'll solve this in court. See you later. So maybe I'm a bit more kind of pro-court solutions than other people. Domestic violence and no recourse to public funds is a huge issue. So if you are a spouse of a British or settled person, on your spouse partner visa, you can have the no recourse to public funds condition lifted by going onto a new sort of visa, a destitute domestic violence concession, which gives you 3 months of access to public funds, and from that you make a further application for indefinite leave remaining as a victim of domestic violence. But that works for a really narrow group, and that is not all of the people who experience domestic violence. That's not all of the people who are in the UK on in the UK lawfully, for example, and experience domestic violence, and then there are also people who are in the UK without documents and are experiencing domestic violence. So particularly, for example, spouses of people who are here as workers or as students. They can't use the destitute domestic violence concession, they can't apply for indefinite leave to remain, and in fact, if they report domestic violence and they report they're separated from their partner, they have 60 days and then their visa is curtailed. So that's a huge disincentive to do anything. It's an ongoing issue. It's a huge issue with women's refuges that they won't take women who are no recourse to public funds. I won't mention any names, but I used to do a lot of training on no recourse to public funds for women's refuges, and one refuge turned around and said at the end of my day, thanks so much, now we know we'll never take any of these women. So, you know, that's... What do you do? Where do you go? Women with children, it's back to the local authorities under Section 17 support. Women with care needs, it's back to the local authority under the Care Act. You know, it just shifts the burden onto local authorities if we don't address domestic violence properly within our immigration system. I can tell you there's absolutely zero political appetite to look more closely at issues of domestic violence and their recourse to public funds. We used to get some support from the Labour backbench, and now the Labour front bench, but we don't get any at all anymore. And, you know, it's taken nearly 2 years of work to get the Home Office to agree that just maybe an asylum-seeking woman in their asylum accommodation experiences domestic violence, maybe they shouldn't go in with their border force boots on, but they should look at moving those women into women's refuges and paying for those services. But that has been years of work and we're not there yet. I don't have a solution. There are solutions we suggest to refugees around going back to basic practice, asking local organisations to fund a refuge space. A lot of refugees are within their local authority area, so they're very large in housing benefit. But like with NALCOM say, well, we've got three people on housing benefit, therefore they're subsidising room four for somebody who hasn't got access to any benefit. You have, you know, we suggest again and again to women's refugees that that's how they should work. And obviously, I say women's refugees, if a man experiencing domestic violence, I think we all know, sorry, unlucky, there is absolutely nothing for you, no services. You will be out on the streets if you open your mouth, which is an utterly unacceptable situation. So yeah, it's sort of back to basics practice, asking religious organisations to fund beds, asking local businesses to fund beds. You know, there is no real solution. I haven't got one.
Okay, I'm going to ask other panel members to respond. There is a challenge around illegal working as well, but maybe Mike, take it first.
The point I wanted to pick up, I think, chance back to respond is your point, which I think is absolutely key, that we do need the way that we change public perceptions. I think it's primarily not through myth busting, although the paper's suggesting that it's not very effective. It's like me saying to Dave, it's not true, your wife is having an affair. That Dave doesn't go away today. Thank God, my wife isn't. Why are you talking about my wife? And that's what we're busting. The thing that people do listen to is family, friends, and colleagues.
Yes.
And they have to take it down to the level. Yeah. They don't listen to me when I'm up in Newcastle. They don't say, what's this shiny drinking Southern Bastard telling us what goes on in Newcastle? They want someone who works in Newcastle talking about it. Even if they don't agree with them, they'll respect their opinion because they're in their community. So what you're talking about is absolutely essential, and that is how we're going to change attitudes in the long term. And it's equally, in my view, important that we engage with local authorities and with Home Office officials in that, because they're not necessarily the enemy. We need to be working with them, and we need... You know, we've done some sessions where, you know, we get refugees to talk to Home Office case officers. They never see refugees, they only see asylum seekers. And it changes their perceptions as well. And then you've got to remember is that on our side, we see all the bad cases, and so we think that's representative. But, you know, someone mentioned the culture of disbelief. Got to remember that we actually recognise, you know, 38% on initial decision and around 40% on appeal, which is one of the best in Europe. So it's not like the 90s where actually we rejected everybody. When we reject, it's normally because there's a policy decision like an Eritrea, which forces the caseworkers to actually take a more restrictive view, not those individuals necessarily. So that, I think, is very key, that we engage with everybody and try and make more allies actually, so that we can change attitudes in the long term.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And a couple of examples, one bad and one good. In Redcar, the local authority decided they were day hammering Syrians. They didn't engage with the NGOs who knew what they were talking about. They've taken 100 Syrians. Redcar has got quite a lot of BNP support, and they're having a lot of problems in the area because they haven't done the spade work, they haven't got local people involved, and there's going to be a lot of trouble. In Skelmersdale, which is equally BNP type territory, they've dispersed asylum seekers there, and the local community has got involved at the very beginning, and there's no problems at the moment because they're engaging from the start. Big difference as to how it's done, you know, and that's really, really crucial. When people meet asylum seekers, they realise they haven't got two heads, they're not going to rob them, and they're probably nice people. And if we can get more people we can get to actually meet them, the better it will be. That's how things change. I totally agree. Other thing I'd say about local authorities, I really have a lot of sympathy for local authorities at the moment. I used to attend the No Recourse to Public Funds group in Manchester, and basically it's gone down. It used to be about 20 people sitting around the table, now it's about 10. And it's everybody saying, this is really terrible, we can't do anything. And for 2 hours. Because of public funds, and that's apart from having meetings and saying you can't. And so I really feel for them, and you know, and that again is a huge waste of public money. One thing I would say is that sometimes departments within local authorities, the same as within the NHS, they're all fighting their own corner, and they need to talk to each other far more. Because through collaborating and sharing stuff, you can sometimes solve a problem. Whereas you can't if you're just defending your own core, then it makes it worse. This, for a very simple example of that, in Salford, they used to have a superb GP practice that was primarily for refugees and asylum seekers. And then Salford discovered that, in fact, a lot of the problems of that were coming from Manchester and Trafford and other authorities. And they said, hang on a minute, we're paying for this. So they then devolved it to the GP surgeries and closed it, which meant that they no longer got specialist support that they needed, and the GPs weren't trained up to actually do anything about it properly. So, but if they'd talked to Manchester and the other said, let's get together, we can fund this together, and it would have worked. So, yeah. Thank you.
I have this question in regards to funding for studies, actually, in connection to non-recourse to public funds. Usually, school finance aspect, does one have to have recourse to public funds? Because I usually, you know, they say that one has to be here in the country for 3 years, so I don't know where the aspect of the non-recourse to public funds or whatever comes in.
Finance for studies.
Oh, yeah, okay, so they, after Tagere, they changed the rules for student loans for higher education. Well, actually, previously, you had to have indefinite leave to remain or be a British citizen or have refugee status. So actually, it's a kind of a loosening up of the rules, but the rule now is... to access student loans, bear in mind they're loans, so everyone has to pay them back, and home fees. You have to have, if you're under 18, you have to have been in the UK for 7 years, of which three must be, you must have been ordinarily resident. Now, ordinary resident means this is your home, your place where you do everything, but it also requires lawful residence, so it means 3 years of having a visa. If you are over 18, it's half your life in the UK, three of which must be ordinary residence, so lawful, and this must be your place of abode. If you've got indefinite leave to remain, I'm pretty sure you still need to pass the 3 years ordinary residence test. But the chances are, if you've got a definite leave to remain, you've been in the UK lawfully for 3 years.
Can I just say this only applies to England, not to Scotland?
Sorry, yeah, there's the England rules, not to Wales.
We've just heard the bell. Bell tolls for us. I'm going to ask Kate to just a final reflection.
I feel like I've gone away with a long to-do list. That's great.
Okay, so cool. Thank you. Thank you.